The first, probably the first handful of slides will be, some people will have seen them before, but just to get everybody on the same page, so that there's a few people, Todd and some others, have seen some of this stuff, but we'll work into some new stuff here. And I will begin by the thinking that brought us to this project, which was looking at a phylogeny tree and realizing that although the sponges lie at the base of the animal evolutionary tree, they have some features that are very different from all other animals. And specifically, they lack all the various cellular phenotypes that the rest of the animals have, and our particular interest is in the nervous system. They lack synapses, they lack neurons, they lack a nervous system. So we became interested in exploring the transition between this basal phylum of animals and all the rest of the eumetazoa that have those features, and looking at that transition. Because indeed, sponges and sponges lack nerve cells, but they, although they do show global responses to external stimuli. Many creatures, almost all creatures do. So
sponges have action potentials, right?
Well, there is, the only place that has been actually given some credence is in this particular branch of the periphera, where the entire sponge is a syncytium, and there you can see electrical conductances. I think it's less clear here in those in the calcarea and the demo sponge.
Maybe there is some sodium
channel. Yes, and I think I will get to some of that. So there are silicaceous sponges, and then this is here, and this is
calcarea are sponges.
Yes. Yeah. So again, in looking now at another way at the evolutionary tree, the recognizable nervous systems actually appear in Cnidaria. And the one that we have the genome from is the Nematostella, which is a sea anemone. And we don't really have anything recognizable as a nervous system in animals that are more basal. So sponges.
Have you guys looked in the placozoa?
So that's a good question. We have not, but there, at least what I've seen in the literature, there is nothing there that looks like a nervous system either. And placozoa is hard to sometimes place exactly where that's going to fit. A lot of it, of its genes, have probably been lost.
The reason I ask is, you know, it's a fairly simple thing.
Yes.
It's thought not to be sexual. It's only got like four cell types, but I think it's got genes for meiosis. So it could be there's other.
Yeah.
There's another developmental form or something nobody's ever seen.
So sponges are an extremely successful phylum. They have, there's, here's a look at them. This will give you a little more information about them here. They, again, I've already mentioned, they have no true tissues or organs. There's a very limited number of cell types, which I'll show you in a moment. However, there are more than 10,000 different species, and with a range in size from a few millimeters to a couple of meters. And yet, with a 600 million year fossil record that we have, there has been really minimal change in their body plans. Yes?
Can you just say what true is?
Yes.
What does that mean, true tissues?
True tissues would be the sense that you kind of an organ system, you know, the heart or the nervous system. It may not be the ideal way of saying it, and but that's what is intended.
So you can say no tissues or organs.
Yes. So others, not me, have identified four cell types in the sponge, and they are listed here. The one that we'll end up paying a little bit of attention to is this one, the choanocyte, which looks very much like it's been adopted from the protozoa that is the most close to animals. I'll talk more about that in a moment. And you can see where these cells are positioned in the sponge, right here, with the choanocyte in here. That's a feeding cell, and this is the way the sponge filters the water and small organisms through its body to extract food from those choanocytes. And well, it's hard to say that because this is just a cartoon, and the size of sponges vary so much.
For example, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm just
but the size of the cells or the whole? I'm sorry. Oh, the size of the cells? 20 microns would be sort of about the range, but. Okay, so as you saw the way those arrows move, there's also, while this sponge has individual cells, there must be, although we don't know very much about it, some communication between them to actually get the passage of water in some sort of synchronous way. The amoebocytes, right there, the amoeboid cells are also to some extent involved in food transport, but they have a structural role as well. Okay, now, although those adult sponges don't look very much like animals, what does look a lot more like an animal is the sponge larva, which is shown here. And many investigators, many of them associated with Bernie Degnan, have actually done a lot of detailed studies on looking at and in placing the sponge among the diploblasts. There are two layers that can be identified here. There's no mesoderm, but you can see an endoderm and an ectoderm within the larva that then becomes those adult forms I already showed. And the sponge genome, which I'm going to talk about, what was sequenced was this larval form from a sponge called Amphimedon queenslandica found at the Great Barrier Reef. So here's the sponge we talked about, and just to begin the conversation, begin the presentation, I'll show you some sort of high-level survey data that we, the way we started this project, which was just to take four representative genomes, the sponge which was just coming along then, the Nematostella, which has had a complete genome, and a representative protostome and a representative deuterostome, humans and Drosophila. And then in looking at those four genomes, we collected a list of genes in the synapse, beginning with genes that are in the postsynaptic density, and simply looked for them in all these genomes. Very, very simple. And then place them within what is the most generic synapse you could possibly imagine. So in this very, very generic synapse, you have a presynaptic side, which basically has two components, scaffolding molecules, scaffolding proteins, and synaptic vesicles, a cleft, and then on the postsynaptic side are receptors and channels that are held in place, again, by a scaffolding layer. And all of this synapse is kept in register, pre- and postsynaptic sides are kept in register by proteins in the adherence junction. beneath the scaffolding layer is more generic machinery. Deeper connections to cell signaling and the cytoskeleton, membrane delivery, components that are present in many, many different cells. It's right in here where there are the synaptic specific proteins. So here's the finding, just to quickly show it to you. Although sponges do not have synapses, they do have all of the proteins, these synaptic, postsynaptic proteins that are shown here in blue. So
the definition of postsynaptic is homologous to, is the biology of this all known, or did, is this a sequence statement, or is this a function statement?
Yeah, this is taking the genes that we know have been, the genes that have been sequenced, and superimposing it on a known protein-protein relationship map of the synapse. So that
from what organism?
Mostly from rat and mouse, some from human. Yes. Yeah. So.
And so when you color it, so everything that's on this is in the rat mouse synapse.
Right.
This is a complete list of what is known.
This is a complete list that has then been tailored down to focus very much in the postsynaptic density, and even there, you'll find key things that are missing here, because we have skewed this toward a excitatory synapse, and so it's very, very much focused that way. We could have done this other ways.
So when it's colored blue, maybe you're about to explain the colors.
Yeah. So when it's colored blue, it means that we have found these genes in the sponge genome.
And that means you found something vaguely homologous?
We found an ortholog that has a 40% identity.
40% identity. On average.
No, they have to meet that threshold.
They have to meet that threshold. So threshold, anything above 40%, you accept.
That's right.
But you haven't shown us anything that you didn't find.
Yeah, now I'm about to show you what we did not find, and those are in yellow, because what's missing is equally interesting to what we found. There's a lot of stuff there that looks like they have some sort of structure that bears a very high resemblance to a synapse, but what's missing is equally interesting. And and the key things that are missing are these ionotropic glutamate receptors, if we focus on this particular type of synapse. If, as I say, we could have done this with a GABAergic synapse and other types of synapse, but for this, which is probably the most common type of synapse in the mammalian nervous system, we see the ones in yellow are missing in sponge, but appeared in the cnidarians. So, and now, pardon me?
Shaker is a voltage gated one, isn't it?
Yeah, so that turned out to be actually interesting, because the sponge probably lost its shaker channel, since there is a shaker channel in the choanoflagellate.
But the one KIR is not,
There are other potassium channels in the sponge, but the shaker channel is not there. Okay, so, and then...
Before you go on...
Yes, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Yes.
I was going to say exactly the same thing. You go first.
Well, I was just wondering about the ones in a sort of orangey brown.
Yeah.
Things like the actin cytoskeleton. Is there no actin in this?
No, so... brown is just, these are large groups of genes that we have not really been delineating here on this, in here, because they clearly have all of that, components of that, and I would have to show you another diagram to show you what's present and what's missing. And in fact, there may be a picture coming up, I think. So the brown here refers more to this very lengthy change in the mammalian NMDA receptor that happened very, very late in vertebrates. And there's a few other small things that happen quite late with a few binding sites that appeared. And stargazing is a late addition to the postsynaptic region, but a lot of the complexes are here.
But the way you draw it and you imply it's always gain, and there's no sort of skipping over or loss.
Well, here the shaker channel turned out to be a loss in the sponge, because it is present in the choanoflagellate.
So it's sort of nested with humans.
Yeah, that's true. It is nested in that way. So.
In other words, if you would have added choanoflagellates at the base, then that would have changed where the inference of the.
That's right, and I will show you a picture that does show that in a, coming up because.
Is that an accident? Us being humans and we've thought of it this way. This should not be a universal feature of our. Everything is as old as everything else. So why isn't sponge? Centric view of the synapse.
it's not ultimately going to be a sponge-centric view. I mean, this is
how did the synapse arise? So it's specifically a synapse-centered view, right? We're wondering how this synapse arose.
I'm just saying the axis makes it very. It's a coincidence that the nesting happens to center on the human end of this axis.
It's very much a coincidence, and this could end up looking more logical once we had more sponge sequences. We only have one sponge sequence out of 10,000 species.
I think you sort of said this since the beginning, but I just want to make sure I understand. So was there some physiology or something that made you, there must have been something that made you think that you would find these kinds of genes in the sponge?
Well,
I'm trying to understand why you...
Yeah. I think...
Or this process, let's say.
Yeah. The thinking was simply that sponge is an animal, and cnidarians have nervous systems, and sponges do not, and genes must come from somewhere. They don't appear de novo. Okay, so this was a our first conclusion after publishing this work was that we. Got very interested in this concept that was first put forward by Stephen Jay Gould, referred to as exaptation, a biological unit originating with and selected for a function other than that for which it was later selected. And usually that refers to more gross morphological features, but here we're talking about a kind of molecular exaptation where some complex of proteins of unknown function was exapted from the sponge to then be used for the evolution of a synapse.
And most of these genes now in rat only function the synapse? They don't have other?
We have really focused very much on those that function in the synapse. We could have constructed these lists other ways. For instance, there's some very nice papers by Seth Grant where he has done isolates the postsynaptic density and does mass spec on everything that's there, and you end up seeing a lot of other more generic proteins. So just a couple more slides that are familiar to a few people, and then we'll move on to newer stuff. All I've shown so far is that the genes are there in the genome. The next thing is that are they co-expressed? So by in situ hybridization for this set of five of them, we showed that they were co-expressed. This in situ was done by Bernie Degnan. In the sponge larva, in a cell called the globular cell, which lies here close to the surface, and those cells not only express these five genes, the transcripts are there, we don't know about the protein, and also, in other work that he's done, he's shown that the same cells, I don't know if you can see this down here, but they have other neural developmental genes also in those cells.
That was everything on your list on the last slide, co-expressed?
Was everything on our list? These are the five that we looked at. Right now we don't know about the others.
Everything we looked at was co-expressed?
Everything that we looked at was co-expressed. We only looked at five.
At the levels you thought they would be?
Well, there was clear signal. They were not all uniquely expressed in this cell. Some of them were expressed in other cells, but the only cell in which they were all expressed was this globular cell.
So when you say coupled with notch delta signaling, there is evidence of lateral inhibition?
Lateral inhibition, I don't know that there's evidence of lateral inhibition. There is a boundary between what, you know, I don't think, I'm not sure if this is an acceptable word, say, in sponge developmental biology, but what people might say is an endoderm and an ectoderm, there's a boundary there, and there may be, it's an area where a good, nice place to look for notch function. Okay, so the next question is, well, at least five of them are expressed in the same cell type, but are they actually, do they bind to each other? Are they working as a complex? Because, as I say, we know that from rat data, but we don't know that in sponge. So, and we still don't know that for a fact in terms of doing co-immunoprecipitations and the things that really have to be done. But we do have indirect evidence because for some of the proteins in the synapse, there are actual crystal co-crystals of the protein bound to its ligand. And one of them is the part of a scaffolding protein called PSD95, which one of its PDZ domains, PDC3, has been co-crystallized with a ligand called Crypt. And this was work done with Bruce Tedor at MIT, and we threaded the sponge sequence into the known crystal structure, and what you see here is the Crypt ligand, and these balls are all the PDZ3 domain. In the PDZ3 domain overall, between sponge and human or sponge and rat, there's about a 50% conservation. But for those amino acids that are in direct contact, and you can see what we mean by contact in terms of van der Waals contacts and hydrogen bonds, those that are in direct contact, shaded in blue, are 100% conserved between sponge and human. We thought this was indirect evidence that at least this interaction was present in the sponge.
Aren't there physiological responses you can look for of these cells to see if they're behaving like a synapse? I mean, in the last slide, if I understood correctly, you identified cells where many of the things that you expect to be in a synapse were co-expressed. So isn't the next experiment to see if the thing is behaving?
It's a very reasonable experiment. It's not trivial to get these larvae. They have to be harvested from the Great Barrier Reef. They don't really grow in laboratories. You know, maybe we should hold the next one of these out there.
Has anyone studied the physiology of these organisms?
Sally Lays has done a fair amount of that, but a lot of her work has been on that hexanactylid, the one that's a syncytium. There's much less on these than I'm aware of. There's really a big hole, I think, in the physiology of what's happening.
Has anyone ever identified a synapse-like structure in any sponge?
No, and it's been looked for. There's been a lot of electron microscopy, and no one's seen anything that looks like a postsynaptic density, a synaptic vesicle, or a cleft.
But I mean, can't you take this insight, or do you not have a candidate cell type and look? Somebody must have sponges in it.
People have done it, but it's, I can only tell you what has really been done already, and that's with a pretty exhaustive ultrastructural look at many different sponges, the cardinal features of synapses do not seem to be there.
Right, but the cell type that you identified on the last slide, which I've unfortunately forgotten by now what it was.
Globular cell, yeah.
Has this ever been examined in detail? I mean, is this insight from the last slide? I don't know. Now you actually have a candidate, which...
There is electron microscopy on the globular cell, and it's still not really clear where this complex lies in relation to that cell. So it's just not clear. It requires probably immuno-electron microscopy.
I mean, it's just sad, isn't it?
Well, this data is only, we're only talking about stuff that's a couple years old.
Okay, so there's still hope.
Yeah.
So can you ask whether these genes are expressed in the adult?
So that's exactly what we're doing now. We are getting, we don't have analysis of this data yet, but we put a lot of this material onto Deep Sequencer, and we now have a lot more data on what's expressed and what's not expressed.
So when you said that people had looked for these kind of structures, I assume that was in the adult?
No, also in the larva. Yeah. Oh, yes.
But I'm not sure. I want to make sure I am thinking about this the right way. There's two ways one could look at it, and that is that you do have some sort of genuine synapse being formed here. But it could be that there's a more fundamental cellular process that's involved in the synapse, which is still preserved here.
Precisely.
Some aspects of it are missing. And indeed, it's more exciting if there isn't a synapse, because now you can see some of the parts. Is that the sort of way to think about it?
Right, so all I can say is that there's no morphological evidence for a synapse. What we cannot say, what Michael's driving at, is whether or not there's physiological evidence for a synapse, and that, I think, remains not sufficiently explored.
And of course, there's at least one other possibility, which is that it's just as derived in the sponge as it is in the rat, right? That it used to be something completely different than both of the existing.
Yes, right. That caveat's going to run through the whole talk.
Respect
to
Michael's question, I mean, are there any
ligand
gated channels or
monitoring? I can show you that data. Now with the genome, we know everything that's there. So I can show you some of the stuff. I don't have that information at my fingertips. So let's now ask the same kind of questions about the presynaptic side. And here is a human presynaptic zone. These are some of the key proteins. Thinking about it in the same way, there's a lot of generic stuff here that I'm not showing, but there's basically a scaffolding region, and there's this synaptic vesicle area, and the synaptic vesicles, in interacting with the scaffolding, move down toward the membrane and fuse with the membrane and release their neurotransmitter into the cleft. Lots of proteins involved in all of that. So if you look at yeast and try to superimpose what's in yeast here, there are these...
That's good, right?
Good? Is that a biological term? Yeast are good.
Sorry, they're not supposed to have synapses, right?
Right.
So therefore, if you don't see anything, then that's good. I mean, with respect to Murray's question, asking, if I understood correctly, asking whether maybe all of these things you're fooling yourself into thinking that there's synaptic function, because it's really a housekeeping function. If you don't see anything in yeast, then that's good, because yeast have synapses.
So, and these are very familiar yeast genes. These are just the snares involved in vesicle fusion. Now, here is the choanoflagellate, and we're going to go into the choanoflagellate in much more detail in a moment, but just to foreshadow that, the choanoflagellate is a single cell organism that, in work through Nicole King and others, has been shown to lie on the tree closest to the animals. It has a number of genes that are seen in animals, some of them quite curious, in fact, like tyrosine kinases and cadherins that are involved in cell-cell relationships, even though this is a single-cell organism from the protozoa. So there's been a lot of interest in the Monosiga genome, and there's a few more things filled in, but it still doesn't look a whole lot like a synapse. A presynaptic. Now, here is amphimedon, and this is sort of interesting because now there's more. Just because this is big doesn't mean it's really prominent. Some of these scaffolding genes like Bassoon and Piccolo don't come in until vertebrates. So the key stuff is the synaptic vesicles and what's down here. And there's a very prominent thing that's missing on the presynaptic side. It's the connection between these synaptic vesicle proteins which exist in the sponge and the scaffolding that links the synaptic vesicles to deliver it to the membrane. This complex is missing. It doesn't appear until the nematostella, where we see true nervous systems, what's called a nerve net in the nematostella. And now we can recognize a presynaptic side.
By the way, you're again using 40% homology as the threshold for this?
Yes. Yeah.
So why did you choose 40%?
What was this?
We could change the threshold. I mean, I thought that was...
Yeah. You're the one that I can't remember the name. What was it using the calcium channels for?
I'm sorry, what was...
What was it using the calcium channels for? Do calcium... there also triggers exocytosis or...
What are they? What is the sponge using the calcium channel for?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know.
But is there in this clearly homologous to the calcium channel that sort of does the synaptic exocytosis in higher?
I'm going to say a cautious yes, because I think I'd have to really look in more detail at the phylogeny trees for that whole family of channels to really answer that.
In the trip channels?
That, again, I don't know the answer to that, but it's easy to find that out. I can look into that.
What would this look like in some of the protist lineages that are pretty active, like cilias?
Yeah, so there's very little of that is there. There are some protist lineages that are closer to coanoflagellates, in which this is more likely to be found. Our sampling of all of those types are pretty minimal still. Absent. Okay. Let me introduce the next one. So I'm just going to show two or three slides that are the sponge genome paper has now been submitted. It was the work was done by Dan Roxar with a lot of help, and we were involved a little bit. And what is emerging from that is that presence of these neural systems, neural gene complexes, I should say, it's not just unique to the nervous system. That the that there is sponge has many, many of the animal genes involved in apoptosis. Sponge has many of the genes that are involved in epithelial cell organization without having anything we recognize as an epithelial cell. And so this concept of exaptation of the of a postsynaptic density to lead to a synapse is, I think, the genome is allowing us to generalize that concept and saying that an enormous number of gene networks have been exapted to lead to animal cellular phenotypy. So I'm just going to, so here I am saying that in words. The sponge body plan has changed little over more than 600 million years. And now, building on that network, has come the cnidarians, has come Bilateria, and those phyla have a huge diversity of body plans. In cnidarians, we have medusoid, polyboid, amoeboid, all these different body plans. And in the sponge, there are the developmental gene families seem to be present in this ancestral metazoan genome. But there are some notable differences. We have key ingredients are there, but what failed, and the phylum is clearly successful, and it's diversified into 10,000 different species, but has not changed its body plans very much. And then something happened that generated a few more, relatively few more changes, at least from our vantage, looks like a few more changes. And some of those differences between the sponge and the metazoan genomes are that there start to be, although sponges have a microRNA biogenesis system, they have eight microRNAs compared to goes up rapidly in Cnidaria. There's some novel domains and domain architectures that appear in Cnidaria. Differential expansion of gene families, many things are happening. But the idea here is that the core network was present in the sponge, but there's some other stuff that must have happened that's really not so clear that now allowed for this massive phenotypic diversification of cell types and body plans and all the stuff that we have in the other diploblasts and bilateria.
If you look at the regulatory, the size of regulatory regions, are they different?
Yes. So there is data that that John Maddock likes to talk about a lot, and many other people, in which when you make a graph of the number of genes from, say, sponge to humans, you're generally in the order of 20,000. And when you graph the number of non-coding RNAs, which are such regulatory units, you're seeing a continual upward trend with complexity. So that's something we have to learn a whole lot more about still. Okay, so that's pretty much what I just said. Okay, now let's zero in now on one gene and one domain that addresses this transition from, say, the choanoflagellate to the sponge and beyond, and look at that in more detail. So now it's colored in the way that somebody suggested, where we're back to the postsynaptic density, and what is in blue is in the choanoflagellate, in single cell, in this single cell organism, and then what is in red is what we see in the sponge, and green is in Cnidaria.
These are additions.
Yes.
These are the unions, or humans is everything.
That's right.
And you're not leaving out, and you're not showing anything that you. You're not showing the negatives, this is only the positives.
That's right, these are additions, yes. And it's really crude, it's narrowed down to focus on what I want to really spend the rest of the time talking about, which is this key scaffolding protein in the postsynaptic density called PSD95.
So many of these blue proteins have their DLG linkers a different color.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. So, the choanoflagellate has the shaker channel, but we would guess, having proven, that it cannot link to PSD95.
What's the origin of such a guess?
Because it lacks the ligand. The ligand.
But I don't understand what going. So, I thought the circly things, ovals, were genes, proteins.
This is a gene encoding the, and these are domains.
Are little things,
like your things? They're the ligands for PDZ domains. I think, let me show you what that is right here. This will help. This globular thing is a PDZ domain, and this is the ligand. It's just, you know, there's enormous amounts of information about this, lots of co-crystals of many of them, and it's studied a lot because protein-protein interactions occur usually over very big surfaces.
It's a very small ligand.
And this is a very small ligand.
And then you probably just didn't find it.
No, it's not there. It's not there.
And how specific is the ligand?
It's fairly specific. It's not there in terms of what we know to be a truly ancient, even in prokaryotes, consensus sequence at the C terminus, which is shown right here. You're looking for a hydrophobic amino acid as the last amino acid, and we don't see that. There's just nothing there that looks like a ligand. But I agree, it's still not definitively proved until we do the experiment. that doesn't look like, from sequence evidence, it doesn't look like it's there. So that's why we drew it this way.
But this is sort of, so of course, a very peculiar situation, right? So now we're staring at this beautifully conserved scaffold with no binding partners to enforce this conservation, right?
Well, no binding partners that we know began to bind.
Well, precisely.
Right.
So then why be conserved, right?
Well, I'll show you what the binding partners are in a moment.
But what one wonders in the situation is precisely, you know, how much these coloring depend on thresholds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a little bit the Sherlock Holmesian situation, right? After you eliminate the impossible, what's left is true no matter how improbable, right? So, the matter of the threshold there is in fact the probability, right?
Right.
So the question is, you know, instead of coloring it, you can sort of
shade it.
Yeah.
You can try to say, you know, what is the probability of, you know?
Yes.
What would happen if you used the flooding genes? Essentially the same result.
Very similar result. Yes. There's a few little quirks in the flood.
Depending on what you're using as the source of genes, right?
It is and it isn't, but it's just as Todd just said, these are based on orthologies. So we're really talking about a whole clade of genes that are this family. And so if we use the fly or we use a human, that whole set that is orthologous to this is discernible, and in coanoflagellates missing this piece.
Well, but I want to return to this missing the piece.
Well, it's missing a sequence.
Missing a sequence, or has 39% homology instead of 40, right? So the question is, can one put some probability, ideally, on whatever it has there to bind the PDZ?
Yes. And the...
For example, we had a talk, Chris Miller was giving a talk.
Yes.
Talked about total divergence in sequence, convergence of structure.
So I would not deny that there is some probability, I don't know what it is, that this coanoflagellate shaker channel can bind to that DL. I don't deny that. What is not there,
right,
is...
But I think what Boris is getting at.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm trying to rephrase this, it's a very broad question. So this is a fascinating plot that you make. It's fascinating. And it sort of encodes, well, it's amazing, actually. But the question is, what's the way to make this plot so that weird thing, because look, I mean, as you said, if it's 39%, then the green wouldn't, but so you're not making, there's got, how does one make this plot?
There's
a better way to make this plot.
A better way to make this plot would be to actually do an experiment.
No, but based on the
and get affinities for this.
But based on the bioinformatics, because bioinformatically, since you've thresholded everything,
right,
that is really right. You know, when you have 40% sequence, 40% sequence homology, then that means there's some probability, right? I mean, I'm just rephrasing what I think I just said, that these things have some relationship. Well, but it could be that 20%, there's no reason, I'm not saying it's very
wrong. No, I completely acknowledge what you guys are saying, that there is some probability that this binds. I don't have any trouble with that. All I'm saying is that the consensus sequence for the ligand, as we recognize it in prokaryotes to humans, is not in the C-terminus. But
sequence is not a terribly good description of any sort of
bind. And I would be the first to say that.
But here we're using this as a starting point for pretty serious logical.
Let me show you another experiment that we did that might help with this. Okay, because let me see where that is. That's coming up. So what I'm going to show you is an experiment in which, in about two slides from now, in which we actually took the tri-PDZ domain. These are all PDZs. from the coanoflagellate and did a 2-hybrid in a coanoflagellate library to see what these binding partners are pulling out, what these domains are actually pulling out in that organism. Are they pulling this out or something else? I'm going to show you the answer to that in 2 or 3 more slides. In the in eukaryotes, PDZ domains bind ligands, and they ligands have this consensus sequence. And by far the most common is a hydrophobic at the end, any amino acid, a serine or a threonine, and any amino acid in the terminal 4 amino acids. Prokaryotes have PDZ domains, and they can bind ligands as well. They also have a hydrophobic here, but the other stuff looks nothing like this, and the hydrophobic at the end is usually a phenylalanine and not a leucine or a valine. Another difference in the prokaryote, the prokaryote PDZ domains have remain very limited, and they usually are present next to another domain that is a peptidase. And that's about as far as it's gone in the prokaryotes. Whereas PDZ domains are positioned next to a vast variety of different domains, so that here in these PDZ domains are next to a guanylate kinase domain, they're next to an SH3 domain shown over here, and another domain at the end, and there's great variation. Okay, so to introduce the experiment I'm about to tell you, let me just introduce this organism now. I should have done it before. So this is the coanoflagellate that is usually lives as a single cell, but can form colonies. And by morphology alone, it looks a lot like the coanocyte in the sponge. When you look at the PDZ domains in coanoflagellates compared to other single cell organisms such as Dictyostelium and Neurospora, and I can show you others, there was the number of PDZ domains exploded in the coanoflagellates and continued to increase in the Metastella. Other domains have different patterns. Thrombospondin didn't take off until the Metastella, but this is what we're interested in here. So there's this great expansion of PDZ domains in Monosiga. And here's what I had promised. So our bait was the tri-PDZ domain from the Metastella PSD95. Put it into a 2-hybrid system and pulled out these strange beasts. None of this we expected. There's nothing there that looks like they were genes that were related to the synapses or anything that we expected.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry, you used an Metastella scaffold?
If I said that, I'm sorry, I meant the coanoflagellate. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. So we used the coanoflagellate tri-PDZ domain in a coanoflagellate library to see what the binding partners were. And these are what we pulled out. Some of them, here's a peptidase, which is really more typical of what you end up seeing in bacteria. And they're all unexpected, but there is something here that's really interesting. The sequences of all of these genes have the consensus sequence of the ligand. This is now the novelty of Monosiga. This was not true, as far as we know, in other unicellulars, whether they're prokaryotes, and we know much less about other single cell organisms. But these, they all have what was that type 1 with a pattern here, valine in the C terminus, you know, often a serine or a threonine here.
Well, what would happen if you just did this with any organism? I mean, that's a pretty simple motif. Mm. Presumably, you would pull out lots of other stuff.
If you So when you do this experiment, say in human or rat, you pull out this motif as well, and you pull out the gene.
Stuff like this in a different way.
Yes. What? Yeah. You pull out a lot of genes that have this consensus sequence, but they tend to be genes that, you know, we found are binding partners for the PSD95 tri-PDZ domain. Here we got binding partners that were surprises, but they had the consensus sequences. I think that's pretty interesting.
So can you ask that question a different way of how many other proteins are there in this organism that have those domains that you didn't pull out?
Yeah.
That, fiber negatives are not really
right. That is really, you need a degree of annotation of the genome to know that is not yet available in Monosiga, which is the colanoflagellate that was sequenced, because you have to actually find where what the C terminus is and where the stop codon is. We don't know that. So what we're seeing here is that the metazoan ligand consensus sequence emerged in the coanoflagellates. That's what we're seeing here, even though the binding partners are different, but the ligand sequence is there.
I'm still having a hard time.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you can either be an S or a T in one position, then an X in the next, and then a whether B or an L in the next. So, I mean, that's one, if you just randomly assemble, you know, acids, 1 in 100 times, you would, you know, every three amino acid group, 1 in 100 times, you'd have that sequence. And I missed
it.
That's what I tried to ask.
Yeah, so if you randomly assemble, that's what happens. But if you look at actual...
Are you searching for this 5 amino acids sequence, or you're searching for something much bigger when you're looking at the end of it?
No. We're doing an experiment in which we do a two-hybrid experiment and pull out some genes and see what their C-terminal sequences are.
Right. So you're pulling out big things,
right,
and then you're looking at the ends of the big things that you're pulling out. So what you're searching for are big things.
We're searching for the genes that interact with the tri-PDZ domain. And
you're saying, oh, now let's look at the end of the big thing.
And the likelihood...
And the end of the big thing is...
The end of the big thing,
and the end of the big thing
tends to be the ligand consensus sequence, which the likelihood of getting that by chance alone is extremely small.
And the candidates don't have it.
I'm guessing it's extremely high, more than 100.
The converse, I believe, is not true. I think just having this consensus sequence at the end of the protein won't make it a strong PDZ binder.
Yeah, uh-huh.
It's just from the small set of candidates they pulled out. This is at the end of every.
So they're looking for they're searching on PDZ binding, and they're looking at the end of it. And
this isn't what's being bound.
No, this is not.
We don't know that this is actually bound. This was bound in the experiment. It was in the two hybrid. We don't know if this is actually happening in the organism. But in the two hybrid experiment, they were bound. That's how they came.
The probability that you find these sequences, 1 over 100.
Every gene should have something like that.
And if you find it
at the C terminus, no way.
No, but not at the C terminus.
The number of genes that have a hydrophobic at their C terminus is not huge. I don't know what the percent is, but it's not huge.
Well, I guess the question that Michael is asking. So, how big was the library, and how many things were pulled out, and what fraction of that had this motif?
Yeah. Everything that you're seeing what we pulled out. You're seeing everything we pulled out that actually withstood all the controls you have to do when you're doing a two hybrid.
Okay, so how many, how big was the library?
Oh, I don't remember. It was a standard library from, I don't remember the actual number of copy numbers of...
1,000?
Oh, probably bigger.
But there's two questions that come to mind. I mean, the cell biology perception is that there's an enormous number of false positives quite frequently in two hybrid screens. So could you verify any of these interactions in vitro would be the first question. I mean, it's not to suggest that it's not real.
Right.
But it's to suggest there's a genuine probability that it may bind in some other way.
So I didn't include that here, but every single one of these was then verified in vitro by expressing this gene and expressing the tri-PDZ domain and then doing a co-IP in a Western blot.
But did you then, the trouble with, of course, with Western blots, the biochemist response to that, is that if you use a Western blot to see it, you can't tell the difference between what you put on and whether there's any specificity in the blot.
Well, so those caveats are true, but these are validated by independent in vitro co-IP, caveat being in vitro.
But you know, what I'm saying is that although there are some people that believe co-IPs that have been validated by Western blots, there are a very large number of people who don't, and they have good reasons for not believing.
Right. The better experiment, which we haven't done, is to now take the organism and do an immunoprecipitation and see what's that right.
Well, no, a better way to do it is to not use a Western blot to visualize what you've got. Because if you stain with silver or Camassi or something, mm-hmm. you can tell whether there is specificity, whether you've pulled out one
right.
band,
yes.
or whether you pulled out the whole lysate, because whatever you're using as bait is sticky.
I wish I had put that slide in here. We, of course, have done the Kumasi and the silver stains on the co-IPs. Okay, yeah, no,
that is a derogar. Issue with this. I wondered if you went back to your PDZ domain.
Yes.
Usually what people detect when they're detecting sequence homology is the residues that are important for generating the particular protein fold. Whereas the residues that are going to be determining the specificity of an interaction will not be those, but will be residues on the surface of the protein which should be strongly conserved. And mm-hmm. I wondered if you went back and looked at your individual PDZ domains like that of separating them into the residues that specify the fold and specifying the residues that indicate the specificity of the interaction on the surface, whether you might find something different here. Because that would be the implication.
That's where we're going.
Uh-huh.
That's exactly where we're going. I'm going to start to show you all the sequences and show you where the specificities lie. Okay, so before we get there, though, let me just now, here's a little piece of a phylogeny tree in which the these lines correspond to the number of PDZ domains, and you can see that for hundreds of millions of years, PDZs never expanded, and then in Monosiga, the coanoflagellate, they expanded rapidly. There was another expansion again here in the vertebrate lineage. Okay, in moving toward what you had suggested, just this shows the data now in another way. very low numbers of PDZ domains, they now take off, and the two bars here represent, the white are the number of PDZ domains. Recall that, for instance, PSD95 has three of them, and the number of genes that hold PDZ domains. So that's what we're looking at here. And so when this was done, we didn't have the amphimedon, but now we do, and it fits very nicely right in there. Okay, so now we're going to get to what you said. Here's the numbers that of sequences that contributed to the data that I'll present. So we started with the bilaterian PDZ domains, okay? So we're not yet talking about sponge or cnidarians, and we took over 4,000 PDZ domains from 39 bilateria, and we then built their trees through symmetric homologies, and found 58 that met our 40% orthology threshold, and we called those groups clades. There were 58 clades, and within those 58 clades were 1,706 PDZ sequences. That consensus PDZ sequence was made up of 76 amino acid positions in this global consensus. And those, all those consensus sequences then represent an estimate of the ancestral state for these lineages. And just to show you now more concretely what I mean by that is that here is what's called the DLG family. PSD95 is one example of that shown first. And you know, I've already mentioned three PDZ domains, an SH3 domain, a guanylate kinase domain, and these PDZ domains are 1, 2, and 3. And what I mean by a clade then is that all of these PDZ domains will look more similar to each other than any of them do to the neighboring PDZ domain. That's a clade across vast phylogenetic distances from sponge to human. Okay? And here's just another example. Another gene, Casq, that has a PDZ domain, and it represents a clade in this context of these other domains. And when you put all the domains together, you now have a gene, and you call it Casq. So here is, again, another way of showing the same thing, a phylogeny tree. It's hard to see it, but it basically just shows that, for instance, PDZ3 of sponge will clade here with the PDZ3 of human. And one more way of showing the same thing is just aligning all of these and now looking at which individual positions have varying degrees of conservation. So let me just now, this picture can be broken down into these categories. So there are some positions that are globally conserved from all through every single PDZ domain we've looked at, and they are in the structural positions that are critical in gene folds. So you know, the famous one is the GLGF loop, which is a globally conserved position. Others are neutral positions. They vary across all of the different species. They even vary within a clade. And then there are classifying positions, which we found the most interesting, because they vary globally, but they are conserved within the clade. They define the clade. That's why we call them classifying positions. So now we set up a little schema to look at that more carefully, and we defined a term that was called within clade entropy. That is, how much variation is there within a clade, and how much variation is there across all of the clades, and graph that as a scatter plot, which you can see right here. So here, this is done with random PDZ sequences, and now done with the data. And within clade entropy on this axis, global entropy on this axis, and there are 6 positions which fall outside a regression line that you see here. 6 positions in of the 76 positions in the consensus PDZ domain. 6 positions that look interesting in the sense that they look like they're going to have the possibility for predicting those positions, predicting what gene that particular example is going to come from. Just 6 positions. And indeed, they do predict very well. If you take just 3 of them in various combinations, you can get an 81% predictive ability. If you use all 6, you get up to 96% precision. Using all 6, you can get a pretty good prediction of what the gene is that it comes from. So, now remember, I mentioned that is just with bilateria. What do those positions look like when you now go back to cnidarians and the sponge and to coanoflagellates? Because they all have a PDZ, PSD95, and the domain structure is the same. But what about the 6 positions? So, in the sponge, those positions are, again, they're 77% orthologous. They have, so they have high predictive ability. In cnidaria, they have even higher predictive ability. But here's the interesting part. In coanoflagellate, those six positions are only 23% conserved. They do not look like classifying positions anymore. That is, the cnidaria, the Monosiga coanoflagellate, has the domain order and the domain structure of all the rest of metazoans, but the six positions that are predictive for the binding elements, those positions are no longer under the same type of selection, perhaps. They don't, they're not, they don't predict the gene that the PDZ domain comes from. So our inference is that PDZ clade classification was not established at the time of the Monosiga animal split, even though the domain structure was. This dissociates these binding properties from the domain structure, one. And then once these six positions were established, classifying positions are conserved over more than 600 million years of evolution, because we can see them in sponge to humans. So there's this two-step process here in which domain organization was established, and then certain binding, apparently binding properties were then diversified. Because clearly, Monosiga has a perfectly good binder to other types of ligands. So where are those six positions in the crystal structures? That's what I'll, yes.
I don't understand this conservation, or rather, it's 23% conserved. I mean, these classifying positions are variable. Mm-hmm. So what does it mean, conserved?
Classifying positions are variable globally, but they're highly conserved within a clade, so that if you're in one of those positions in, say, PDZ3, you would know that in,
so it's
always
conserved within the clade?
Almost completely conserved. You saw the percentages. Yeah, it's very, very high.
He's looking at many different PDZ domains in Montecito. So.
Yes. So you can now ask, where are those six positions in the crystal structure of the PDZ domains? And here's where they are. Four of them in red are in proximity to the ligand. Yes, I'm sorry.
Being lost there.
Okay.
Especially Claude's remark that there are very many PDZ domains that in Monosiga that we're studying now. But so the clade situation was very clear.
Right.
When you had this DLG and there were three different PDZs and they belonged to different clades. Now with Monosiga, how do I know what clade is what?
Yeah, so in Monosiga to know, it's much harder to clade in Monosiga, but what we built into the algorithm the fact that if the domain order was conserved, then we would say that this would be this had the potential for being in that clade, and then we would look and see what the conservation is. So when we saw the organization of the PDZ domains as a tri-PDZ domain with an SH3 domain and a GK domain in Monosiga, we then, even though the orthology...
That's just three domains, right? But so if I understand correctly, there were many other examples of PDZ domains in other genes.
Casc, for instance, yes. There are many other PDZ domains that have that their neighbors are other domains.
But
and those neighbor relationships.
This number on conservation depends on our ability to identify clades
based on the
domains over a large number of genes.
That's right.
So then it should be viewed in the context of, you know, some other measure of, you know, similarity of domain composition. Now, because, you know, if we start comparing, you know, whatever, Montesigan and the Metastella, and we yeah. see that there's a lot of domain shuffling going on,
right.
you know, for all I know, just to make your life difficult, it decided to permute all its PDZ domains, right?
Yes. So that's why we required that there was domain synteny. And that was that's our measure for looking for clading.
Well, I guess I'm sort of asking if one could produce another number, you know, some measure of, you know, preservation of domain structure, which would look not only at PDZ domains, but various other things that, you know.
Such as?
You know, such as... you know, GSK, you know, whatever domains you can identify, right? Just on the level of, we're now talking about...
you mean to do the same analysis?
You know, coarse comparison of genes, right?
Just so you're saying...
identifying, right? You know, you're trying to distinguish different clades of PDZ domains, which is a greater challenge than... you know, distinguish, you know, identifying PDZ, any PDZ and you know, any other domain, right?
So are you saying that this other number would be a way to generalize this to other domains, or are you saying that you're looking for the domains that are associated with these PDZ domains and to actually start to put a number on that?
Okay, maybe we should continue.
Okay. Okay, so the six positions that function well to classify the gene from which the PDZ domain derives is four of them in red lie in proximity to the ligand. And and you remember that consensus sequence said that there was a hydrophobic in the end, that's called the zero position, and then there's any amino acid which is called minus one, and then minus two was the serine or threonine, and then there's minus three, which was again any amino acid. So the four positions, not only are they in proximity to the bicrystal structures for most of these, the ligand, but they also, in not universally, but almost always, contact the minus one and minus three positions, the variable positions in the ligand, suggesting some ways, perhaps, of looking at coevolution for a ligand in the domain. The other piece of interest here is that the remaining two positions are pretty mysterious. They're far away from the ligand, and it is not at all clear why they show up as classifying positions.
If you remove them, do you lose much of classification?
If you remove
do your classification
yes.
with four rather than six,
you still get very good classification. Yes. Even with three, you get very good. And you can remove these two and still get good classification.
So
there's a quick question.
Yeah.
That is that you have a large number of PDZ domains, and I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to this, I should. Uh-huh. But it's clear that the PDZ domains are not completely promiscuous. They recognize particular molecules.
Right.
So in addition to having your consensus sequence, there must be some additional information that allows them to recognize their correct partner.
Yes.
I don't know what the basis of that is.
Right. And so that's been looked at. There are a couple of recent papers where now those consensus sequences have been further refined, in which people have put random 5-mer or 6-mer peptides that are that have a hydrophobic always at the end, but they change it, and you get this vast number of peptides that with different five mers at the end, and look at how they can begin to classify these. And so there is, so I think you're absolutely right. There is greater refinement that's emerging.
It's solely at the C-terminus, Brandon, doesn't
it? Oh, the recognition.
Anything else about the other protein it's binding to? I would find it difficult to understand how they would find the right partner.
How they would find the right what partner when the recognition is solely at the C-terminus?
Yeah.
Well, the recognition is solely at the C-terminus.
Okay, that's what happens.
That's not to say there aren't other parts of the molecule that are important, and that there aren't other parts of the molecule that are involved in other types of PDZ relationships. The only other one that we know about is that there is also in nitric oxide synthetase, which has PDZ domains, two PDZ domains can also interact. Which is a much less common type. This is by far and away the most common. Yes?
In these, if you get the structures without the ligand bound, is there a conformational change, for example, on the green end?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, but that might be known. I just don't know if ligand binding shifts those, but that's, yeah. When I was trying to look into an explanation for this, I actually probably should have probed that more deeply, because there is this concept that you guys probably know better than I do about conformational epistasis, and where these, where more than one site operating together can be important in maintaining a conformation of a protein. So, anyhow, So that's where we are. Now in summary then for this part, what we have concluded here is that the pathway to the evolution of the animal PDZ domain operates something like this, where coanoflagellates evolved PDZ domains largely through gene duplication that and domain shuffling, in which the PDZ domains took on a host of new neighbors, each other and other domains. And when that happened, they also seem to assume these class one binding properties. That is, they took on the property of binding to a valine at the C-terminus. It had that metazoan property of binding. But the actual binding partners, even though the ligand, the structural relationship between the PDZ domain and the ligand was now beginning to be established, the actual binding partners themselves bore little relationship to what's happening in the rest of in metazoan. This is so on this proto-metazoan stem, we have the appearance of domain organization and class one binding.
Why would you fix the properties of the ligand and not the binding partner? The function is to stick to each other.
Well, I'm sure your speculations would be as good as mine.
But you agree that this is odd?
I don't know that it's so odd. I think that the monosiga has a very different job to do with its scaffold than other metazoans. That the scaffold was exapted for other...
So you just say that the scaffold was adapted for other functional reasons other than sticking?
No, it's for sticking, but sticking to other things.
Only sticks to other things other than that.
Yeah, that's what our two hybrids showed us. That it's stuck to a lot of other things. They just aren't things that we recognize.
Well, those are real. So those are real.
Right? I think those are real. We, you know...
Those are actual, and by real, we mean actual, in vivo, you know, functional...
Yeah, and I haven't proven that, but I think they are real.
And you think that this is sort of multiple, under multiple use, so there are multiple selective pressures, and so... You know, you've got on one hand this thing that has to bind, to stick to lots of things, and then you've got this particular ligand. And this is the fight that's going on.
Some of those things seem pretty weird. I mean, in the cases,
But is there one possible explanation that the protein is in a different place?
Yeah.
In other words, it could be that although in a few hybrid screen you can find all of it, that could be correct. But let's imagine, for example, in a simplified case, that the PDZ domains are normally in the cytoplasm.
Correct.
Whereas in the case where they're unusual, you put them in the nucleus, mitochondrion or so.
Yeah.
So that they then have a different spectrum of proteins with which they can interact.
Yeah. Well, helicases can be in the cytoplasm. There are ones that unwrap microRNAs that are in the cytoplasm. So, but your point's still well taken, that this is an experiment. The reason there's several reasons I think they're real, but I don't know for a fact they're real. The only reason I think they're real is that MonoSiga has a tri-PDZ domain, and all the genes to which tri-PDZ domains bind in the rest of metazoa are not really there very clearly in MonoSiga, and yet the domains are there. I would think it's binding to something, and maybe it's what we found.
Yeah.
Oh yes. Yeah. I'm not saying you get all of them, but you get a lot of the ones that we expect. Yes.
The one that you are picking conoflagellate, you also picked in.
Oh, you know, you don't see those. Those are indeed those are strange. I think you could make an argument that they may not be real. We haven't proven they're real, but it's.
In mouse, there would be no evidence that there is a functional relation
between those type of genes. That's right.
That makes it seem more real, right? So if you do it in mouse and you get the things that are in the synapse and you don't get this other background stuff, and you do it in this and you get this other stuff, it makes it look like it's not just background noise.
But you would get this background in mouse, or wouldn't you?
We don't see this background in mouse.
We don't see this background in mouse.
If it's background.
No.
We should have had a week on evolution of sticking.
Yeah.
Literally, this happened. There's not just this example, right? This is, we could have four words.
Yeah.
No,
okay, so,
no.
So the. It's a great topic. I mean, we.
Because it's just because that is what is the. Because on one hand, right.
But remember that not all of these may be functional.
Right, no, I know it.
It could be that they're accidents, and it's not worth it to get it wrong.
No, I understand that. I guess what I meant to say is, let me sort of say my comment another way. So, I would never, studying the physics of adhesion scares the hell out of me. I would never work on the physics of adhesion. It's too complicated. It's too complicated for me to work on physics of adhesion. So this is even worse, right? Because this is like, you know.
Well, see, I think where this may be interesting is in some of the other conversations that you had talked about here do you need all four of them, or does having one of them decrease the fitness? That's where I think there's some room for some conversation. I don't know. All four of those that are adjacent to the ligand, you know, the ones that look like classifying residues that are adjacent to the ligand, or all six, do they have to happen together? Do you decrease fitness when you have just one?
How hard is it to actually, I guess you've answered this too, that is to actually do the functional assays to find out, right, you know, what fraction of these are.
We began to design some experiments to do that. I mean, you can do crude type of experiments where you just look at co-IPs and affinities and try to figure out something, and that's not all that good. I've had discussions about actually looking at this with things like laser tweezers, in which you would actually put in mutations and measure the actual force to pull them apart. And so there would be interesting things to do. Okay, so kleinoflagellates, we got the domain organization for this gene and the class 1 binding properties, but it wasn't until we were in sponge now where we begin to see the suggestion for binding partners that are now recognizable in metazoa and the emergence of classifying residues that now pick out. This is just vague stuff we don't understand. This is stuff that looks familiar. And those six positions then, as the clades began to radiate, that's where diversification came in the PDZ domain. That the way in which we got more and more diversity in binding partners of PDZ domains was by evolution operating on just six positions. As a hypothesis. Final speculations here, and this sort of goes back to the beginning of the talk, covers the whole thing now, is that the evolution of the nervous system required network strategies by which novel binding partners can compete with pre-existing ligands in a manner that does not disrupt the assembly of the postsynaptic complex, or a proto-postsynaptic complex, whatever that thing is in the sponge. Upregulation of scaffold protein expression represents a possible solution to this issue. Just make more of them, and now you open up binding sites so that the competition operates in a different way. Indeed, most of the scaffold proteins represent abundant components of the synapse. PSD95 is the most abundant protein in the postsynaptic density. Relatively minimal modifications of the core modular structure, that is that unit that we suspect exists in the sponge, could result in functional evolutionary leaps. Small change, the addition of ionotropic glutamate receptors to a pre-existing scaffold allows exaptation of that molecular unit to now operate as an ionotropic postsynaptic element. The existence of a versatile protosynaptic complex suggests that the postsynaptic junction has a modular past, which is seamlessly inapparent except through its evolutionary history. You don't see this sponge unit when you look at its synapse. You don't see it physiologically. You don't see it in any other way. There's something in there that only emerges when you look at the evolution. You couldn't have predicted that hidden within the postsynaptic complex is something else that could function.
Well, if you knew everything about sponge biology, then you would know that.
Right.
On the other hand, maybe, so obviously we don't know much about sponge biology, but how about the you know, human synapses? So what do we know about the role of the scaffold in postsynaptic function? So, you know, for example, I know a little bit about one PDZ scaffold in invertebrate for the transduction, and so again, that thing binds to a bunch of things in microvillus where all the calcium signaling is done, and so there are knockouts for this INAD. And these knockouts have rather mild phenotypes, I believe. So, for example, it will still spike, and the fly will still respond to light. But then the spike does not inactivate. And but I think there's also evidence that it plays a big role in localizing those components to the microvillus in the first place. And so one possibility, speculative hypothesis might be that the scaffold is its job is to localize, right? So if you like, so it's so the definition of a synapse as a location, right? As a compartment, right? And then anything that it doesn't have to be functioning as a sort of synapse the way we know it and love it, but just as a molecular compartment.
Yeah.
So is there? But what is? I intended this to be a question, not a.
Yeah. Well, if you knock.
What do we know about?
If you knock out PSD95. And remember that PSD95 is one member of a family of paralogs. So the caveat being other things may be substituting. you see, you do get a phenotype. And that phenotype is an impairment of learning and memory and a change in LTP. So that, and it's actually a change in a surprising direction in that you get increased LTP. I can only tell you the data.
But you still get sort of postsynaptic response on sort of short time scale.
Yes.
It's a rather mild
phenotype. It's a rather mild phenotype. Yeah. Because if it's something as complex as a synapse, maybe the scaffold is really like a scaffold. You built it up, and now the rest of the synapse has enough complexity to hold itself together. And the scaffold becomes a little bit redundant.
Mm-hmm. So this is consistent with this flight collision abduction story. There, too, it's a mild phenotype. Mm-hmm.
But usually all you're doing is just increasing the
local concentration. Right.
You don't have to bind very strongly to do that. You can have micromolar binding or weaker. It's very difficult to detect. It'll increase the local concentration, so everything just works better. It's a bit like a realtor. Yeah. You know, a realtor puts the buyer and seller together and the houses sell faster. If you didn't have a realtor, it would still actually work. It would just be a mess.
It might have had a more crucial function when this thing was getting started.
Well, it's crucial, you know, you die in the long term if it's not working. But you don't die instantly.
Yeah, so the problem is that you're evolving something, which is in the argument of the next exponential. If you evolve something which is in the argument of an exponential, then it's much harder to get signal, sure.
Right.
It looks like that's
the point.
Could I ask about your comment that there's an increasing diversity of ligands? Whereas nearly, I could have imagined that there was quite a wide spectrum of ligands that the undefined early PDC domains could bind to, but then they crystallized their preferred partners later on. Is that the data somehow?
What do you mean by crystallized their
partners? They somehow homed in on a set of partners which they worked with, and then from then on, all the radiations involved the smallest set of potential partners.
Yes. So that's actually, I agree. I completely agree with you that in some ways the potential has been narrowed, but but within that narrowed potential, it's more fully explored. Is that saying the same thing you're saying, right? Okay. So this is just people that helped and. A lot of people, including many great comments over the last few years from Boris and people in his group, Richard and Pierre and others. So, thank you.
Okay, so I would propose that...